For those of you that like titles, the title of the message today is The Unblemished Offering. I thought today we would start at the very beginning. It's a very good place to start. I heard that in a song one time. When we read, we begin with Genesis. And when we sing, we believe we begin with Do-Re-Mi-Sis. I don't know. Something like that. So let's turn over to Genesis chapter 4. I want to start by looking at Cain and Abel and their offerings to God in Genesis chapter 4 and verse 3. And here we see it says, and in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of fruit of the ground to the Lord. Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. It's interesting as you look at this, there were obviously instructions on what a proper offering was. Because when we see Abel, he brought the right kind of offering. He brought the first of the flock. He brought the fat. He brought the best that he had. How did he know to do that if there weren't instructions on what kind of offering to bring? And yet when we look at Cain and his offering, we see a much different offering. And yet Cain was upset by the fact that God didn't accept it. And as we look at this, it's fairly clear that Cain's primary issue here was one of attitude. There are obviously these exceptions, and Abel knew those, but yet he thought, I'm sure, by the fact that he was angry, that his offering was good enough. It would be fine. God would accept it. And when it wasn't accepted, that's when he got upset. And so one of the attitudes that I would attribute here to Cain is one of complacency. To be complacent, the dictionary definition on that is to be pleased, especially with oneself or one's merits, advantages, situations, often without awareness of some potential danger or defect. Self-satisfied. I think that pretty well defines what Cain thought of his offering. He thought this was a perfectly fine offering. He was satisfied with it. And then when God didn't accept it, that's when he got upset. Now let's take a look, keep that in the back of your mind. Now let's look forward to Romans. We'll skip forward a few thousand years. Romans chapter 12 and verse 1. Romans 12 and verse 1, Paul says here, he says, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. So here we see that we are to be a living sacrifice. We're to be a living offering to God. And much like the offerings in the past, there are expectations of what that offering is to be like. And one of the things that we want to make sure, as we read down, Paul gives us a warning. He says in verse 2, he says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Verse 3, for I say, through the grace of God given to me to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith. So he gives a warning here about that same attitude, the attitude of complacency, thinking so highly of yourself that you think that you are a perfectly acceptable offering to God when you may not be. We don't want to overlook things, as was mentioned in the sermonette. So to see what a valid offering should be, Let's now go back a few thousand years where it's explained again, and we'll look at Exodus chapter 12, where the Passover is explained to the children of Israel. Go to Exodus chapter 12 and verse 1. Exodus chapter 12 and verse 1, it says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, This month shall be your beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, On the tenth of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb, according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next to his house take it according to the number of persons, according to each man's need, you shall make your count for the lamb." Now here we see the explanation. It says, "Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year, and you may take it from the sheep or the goats. Now you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month, then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight." Now we understand that Christ ultimately was that unblemished offering. That was the symbol that he portrayed. But yet, it gives a good explanation of the kind of offering that God expects. These are his expectations. And if we really look at this and look at it closely, we would say, well, he's expecting a lamb without blemish. How can I ever meet these expectations? Well, let's look forward to Daniel chapter 1, because we see a very similar explanation used there. The idea here in the term blemished is to give the best that there is, the best that they have. Get over here. Daniel chapter 1 and verse 3. Says, "Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the noble men, in whom there was no blemish," using the same word there, "but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge, and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom there might, in whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans." So we see the same word here, this word blemish. Do we think, as we look at David and his friends and the people that they brought in, that those people were absolutely without flaw? There was nothing in them that, you know, no marks on their face or hands. Everything was absolutely perfect. Well, probably not. So what does it mean to be unblemished? And if we are to be an unblemished offering, what does that mean to us? How do we move this forward? I talked in a message back in the Twin Cities about the Olympians and what it takes to be an Olympian. And one of the things that came up there was they have a quality about them that good is never good enough. They are never complacent. You will not find a complacent Olympian, because if good was good enough, they would stop. And people would surpass them. And those would be the best of the best. One of the ones that I always think back to is Carl Lewis. He was one that was running when I was growing up, and so that was the guy that I always looked at because I was in track and field. I thought, boy, this guy is absolutely amazing. Carl Lewis set his personal record at 26 feet 8 inches in the long jump in high school. That's an incredible jump for a high schooler. It then took 2 years after that for him to break that record. Now, how many times do you think he jumped in those 2 years? Thinking, oh, you know, 26.8, that's a great jump. Why would I need to beat that? That's a fabulous jump. But good was never good enough. And he knew he had a goal set in his mind that he wanted to be an Olympian. He wanted to be an athlete. That's where he wanted his money to come from. So then at age 19 in college, he bested his personal record by another foot and a half in one jump. And at that point, at age 19, he was the second best long jumper in history. Okay, well, that's a great place to stop. I'm the second best in history. And the guy that beat him had a wind-aided, altitude-aided jump. And so it was already what they call tainted. You know, it was a long jump because, you know, he was in perfect condition. So, you know, why try? But then he continued. He beat that jump. That jump was 8.62 meters. So then he bested that at 8.76 meters, again at 8.79 meters, again at 8.83 meters, and his longest jump ever, 8.87 meters, just falling short of the 8.9 meters that the number one guy had. When you think about this term, without blemish, when we think of ancient Israel and the millions of people that they had in ancient Israel taking their lambs, do we think that there were millions or hundreds of thousands of absolutely perfect, no blemish on them whatsoever, lambs in ancient Israel? No. So then that brings up the question, what does blemish mean? If we look up in Strong's, the Hebrew 8549, the other words that are used to describe it are entire, integrity, truth, complete, full, perfect, sincerely, sound, without spot, undefiled, upright, and whole. So now you take that definition, in the hundreds of thousands or millions of lambs, do we think that the attitude of the people giving those lambs were full of integrity? Full of truth, trying to give the best that they could give. If they found a lamb that was not suitable for God in their flock, then they would go to somebody else's flock and find one that was better. They would find the best of the best, and they would give that to God. When we look at Lewis, he actually bowed out of a world competition one time because it was at high altitude, and he did not want his record to be tainted. When they jump at high altitude, they put a parenthesis A at the end of the record to show that it was high altitude, that the air is thinner, and so there's less resistance on you as you're jumping, and so they consider that a tainted record. And he didn't want that, so he bowed out of that particular competition. In ancient Israel, when they picked out a lamb to give to God, they were giving the best of the best. You were not giving him a lamb that was on its deathbed. Well, it's almost dead anyway. And God doesn't eat meat, so what does he care? You know, he's not going to taste it. You know, my family, they've eaten mutton before. They'll do fine with it. You know, we'll kill that. That wasn't the idea. The idea was quality, excellence, always trying to improve, always trying to give the best of the best. So now, as we look with that definition in mind at this time of year, Passover, where we are trying to look back on ourselves, see what faults, what blemishes we have, and improve upon those, now it makes it much clearer as far as how we can start to remove some of those blemishes from our lives. Let's turn over to Colossians chapter 3. When I think of quality and excellence, I think back to the way Mr. Herbert Armstrong had envisioned Ambassador College. It changed a lot by the time I got there. One verse always stood out in my mind, and that's in Colossians chapter 3 and verse 23. It says, "And whatever you do, do it wholeheartedly, as to the Lord, not to men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance, for you serve the Lord Christ." When Mr. Herbert Armstrong was making the college and making these buildings and having people do the construction there, he understood this verse, that he wasn't making this to be idolized by men, to have men of Pasadena say, "This is the best concert hall that we have in the area." He was doing it because he was doing it to God. He knew that the performances that would be given in there would be performances to worship God. And he wanted to do that in the best possible place. One of the SCPs I went to, they focused a lot on this verse, and we had KP duty. Every dorm had KP duty. And part of our job for kitchen patrol, first, was to come in and set up the places for the dorms to come and seat and sit. And so we would, you know, come in and set down plates and napkins and silverware every day. And then everybody would come in and they'd sit, they'd do the prayer, and then people would take their plates through the line. And this verse was driven into us as we're setting down these plates. If you got something out of place, counselor would come over and say, "Would God be happy sitting down at the place that you're setting?" "No, probably not. All right, let me straighten this, tweak this over here." And he was saying, you need to be setting things up as if you're presenting them in front of God. And if you do that, you will be always putting your best foot forward. So how do we take this and transition this into our lives? Well, one of the things that business over the last 10 years has been working on has been, how do we improve quality in business? How do we produce excellence in business? And one of the things that they go back to is what's called the Toyota Production System. At the end of World War II, Japan was really devastated, and much of their industry was devastated. And when you look at Toyota as a company, at the end of World War II, they had 3,000 employees and no working facilities. And for the next couple decades, they really struggled trying to pull anything back together. They had a lot of union battles to contend with, and obviously a lot of heavy outlay just getting the equipment to get their lines back up and running. In 1967, Eiji Toyota took over as the president of the company, and he said, "We're going to basically take everything offline for a little bit, and we're going to figure out how this works and how to produce a quality product." And the system that he developed later became known as the Toyota Production System, or as many books label it today, total quality management. And so today what I want to do is I want to say, how can we take that total quality management idea and the steps from that and bring them into our own lives to produce a quality product that we are willing then to present to God? The first step that he came up with was to focus on continuous process improvement, to make the processes visible, repeatable, and measurable. Make the processes visual, repeatable, and measurable. When he took over, Toyota pretty much had the American philosophy, which was you run a machine until it breaks, then you bring in a specialist to either fix it or replace it. And those specialists are obviously cost a lot of money. When the machine breaks, just prior to it breaking, there's a decrease in quality because it's producing the widgets worse than it was when it started. There's downtime while they're fixing or replacing the machine. He said, we don't need that. We can do this ourselves. So he took everything offline for several weeks, and he handed out spiral-bound notebooks to every employee. And he said, I want you to figure out how this machine works. Take it apart, put it back together. I want you to know every screw that turns, every nut that twists, every knob that turns, everything I want you to know about this system, and I want you to put it in this book. And so at that point, everybody started writing down in their book, okay, my machine with these settings makes 10 widgets a week. And so now they had a visible process. This much material comes in, it goes through my machine with these settings, and out come 10 widgets on the other side. It was repeatable. It was measurable. When we look at our lives and our Christian lives, do we have a process that is repeatable, visible, measurable? Do we have a baseline that we work off of? And prior to making this message, and I looked at that and I thought, do I have written down anywhere in a spiral-bound notebook how many times I pray in a day, in a week? How many times I fast? How many times I meditate? How many times how much time I spend on Bible study? What I've done for Bible study? I sort of have it in my mind. I sort of, have a rough idea, but I don't have anything documented. And so then, when I go a year later and things have gradually improved or gradually declined, it's very tough to see because it happens over time. It's like the frog in the water, right? So the first thing you need to do is make sure that you have a baseline. You know where you're starting from. And all of us are starting from different places. Then from there, another term that's become very popular in business is create SMART goals. The acronym SMART stands for specific, measurable, assignable, realistic, and time-related. SMART goals. So if you had a goal, for example, in your Christian walk that I want to be better, well, that's nice, but it's a bad goal because it's not specific. What does it mean to be better? It's not measurable. It's not time-based. How long are you going to spend being better? Let's say you had a goal of, I want to study the Bible 16 hours a day. Well, again, more power to you, but you still need to eat, you still need to sleep, you still need to take care of your family and all the other things that go on in life. It's not realistic. You can't do it. If you said, I'm going to read a chapter in my Bible every day before I leave for work or school in the morning, now there is something that's much better. It's specific. It's time-bound. You're going to do it in the morning before you leave. It's realistic. It's something that's attainable until you get to Psalm 119. Then maybe you want to break it up a little bit. But for the most part, you can do that. You can do a chapter. I was talking to a student one time that said that they have a long bus ride, half hour, 45 minutes, something like that, so they have the Bible downloaded to their MP3 player. And so their goal was to listen to the Bible on their MP3 to and from school. Well, it's realistic, it's time-bound, it's specific. That's a very good goal for them to set. I talked to someone else in the Twin Cities, and this is something that I always had a challenge with. Usually when I walk into church, I see somebody I know, and I start talking to them, and then you see somebody else, and you start talking to them, and pretty soon you've hit, maybe five or six people. But there's no real way to know, over the course of a month or something, have I talked to everybody? Because some people are quiet, they're off in the corner, whatever, and you just don't make it over there. And so what he did was he took his church list and he divided it out, and he had one or two names every week that he would make a point to talk to them. If I do nothing else, I'm going to talk to this person. And so that way, from a visitation standpoint, he had his goals set out, he had his baseline set of what he had done before, it was all documented, and he was able to improve year over year. Fabulous idea. I had never thought of it. Turn over to Acts chapter 10. I want to focus for just a moment on prayers. Acts chapter 10 and verse 1 says, "Then there was a certain man in Caesarea called Cornelius, a centurion, that was called by the Italian regiment, a devout man, one who feared God with his whole household, gave alms regularly to the people, prayed to God always, and in the ninth hour he saw clearly a vision from the angel of God coming down and saying to him, 'Cornelius.' And when he observed what he had he was afraid and said, 'What is it, Lord?' So he said to him, 'Your prayers and your alms have come up before a memorial before God.'" And then he sends him off to see Peter. Here was a man who was doing the best that he could, probably in pretty tough situations, being a Roman, praying to God, giving alms to the poor. And we see that it comes, it says that your prayers have come up as a memorial before God. Our prayers are very important to God. What are we creating when we pray to God? We're creating a relationship with Him. And what would a relationship be if you never communicated with your partner? A marriage wouldn't be very successful if you never talked to your wife or your husband. You have to talk to the person that you're in a relationship with, or it's not going to succeed. So he had this routine that he would pray. We see in Luke chapter 4, verse 16, I'll just reference over there, it says that Christ, as was his custom, went into the synagogue. So he had a habit. He went into church every week. You know, we tell people in our church that you need to come. You need to create a habit of coming, fellowshipping, learning. In a lot of modern Christian churches, that is not the expectation. And if that's not your habit, that's not going to be what you do. It needs to be habit. It needs to be custom. It needs to be your custom. We see the same thing with Acts and Paul in Acts chapter 17, where he goes, as was his custom, he went in three Sabbaths and reasoned with them from the Scriptures. He went into the synagogue of the Jews. A very similar thing there. So whatever we do, we need to make the process visible. We need to make it repeatable so that we can improve upon it. The second step, once we have this repeatable process, is that we need to focus on intangible effects that either improve the process or degrade the process. Now, when you think about David, David was called a man after God's own heart. When he was out tending his sheep, what do you think are some intangible benefits that he would have gained by being out there tending sheep? Well, we obviously know that he learned a certain amount about faith in God and God's protection of him, because he was willing to go take on a 9-plus-foot man with a sling and a stone. More than I do. I like to say I have faith in God, but that would definitely test it. You know, here, have a stick. Go chase that guy. So he obviously learned a certain amount of faith in God there. He learned, I think, a certain amount of respect for the sheep that he was taking care of. And when he was put in charge now of the nation of Israel, and expected to take care of now a new flock, he was able to do that, and able to do that with kindness and care. I think he also learned a certain amount of honor. Honor of his family. He's out there in the middle of nowhere. And what he does is going to be observed by other people and traced back to his family. One of the theories around why crime has increased so much recently is the anonymity of people. Nobody knows who anybody is. When I was growing up and going to school, our school was very small. And my parents were very involved with the school. If I did something at school, I know my parents would find out. And, you know, punishment at school would not be the only thing I'd have to worry about. And, you know, when Dad was growing up back in the 30s and 40s, everybody knew everybody. You were in small towns. If somebody acted up, you know, you'd probably get whacked by every neighbor, you know, coming down the street that heard about what you did. And that portrayed a certain amount of honor. Turn over to Exodus chapter 20. It's interesting that God put this in the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 12. It says, "Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you." When we look at the Ten Commandments, we understand much of this. Okay, I shouldn't murder, I shouldn't commit adultery, that all makes sense. Shouldn't steal. Okay, perfectly fine. Honor my father and mother. Why? What does that carry with it? And why is that sandwiched in between all of the commandments on how you treat people and how you treat God? Well, I think we'll see that in a moment. Turn over to Leviticus chapter 19. Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 32. Here again we see a verse on honor and respect. It says, "You shall rise before the gray-headed and honor the presence of the old man and fear your God. I am the Lord." Now people indicate to me that my hair is getting grayer. I don't believe them. I think they're doctoring the photos. But you're supposed to rise before the gray-headed. We are, you know, teaching our son the same way that I was taught when I grew up. If an older man walks into the room, you give him your seat. You get up. That's respect. That is honor. We look back in Ephesians where it talks about we're supposed to honor our wives, giving honor to them. So over and over again, we see this reflection of honor scattered throughout the Scripture. Turn over to Proverbs chapter 18 and verse 12. Again, this is one of those intangibles that I want to focus on. Proverbs chapter 18 and verse 12 says, Before destruction, the heart of a man is haughty. And before honor is humility. You cannot give somebody honor without humbling yourself. It's impossible. You cannot be haughty and honor somebody. So one of these intangibles would be honor. How are we looking to honor God? Getting back to prayer for a moment, there are a lot of informal prayers that we give on a regular basis. You know, we see something that catches our eye, we acknowledge God for it. But at the same time, there is a place for formality in our prayers as well, where we get down on our knees and we pay respect and we honor the God that created everything around us. From the planet that we're on, all the rules and laws and functions that make it work like no other planet in the universe, to all the stars and the planets circling those, all the way down to the most finite atoms, and making all of this work together. Absolutely incredible. You know, if that doesn't bring a certain awe and respect to your life, there's something wrong. You know, that should bring us to our knees, to worship the God that created all of this. Turn over to Ephesians chapter 3. Sort of reiterating that same point. Excuse me, Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 14. Talking about the majesty of God, and it says, "For this reason I bow my knees to the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, from whom the whole family of heaven and earth is named." An incredible God that we serve. And for that reason, we should be willing to humble ourselves, bow before Him, and pay that respect. How about taking an intangible, like the way that we sing in church? Now, how many of us, when we sing in church, we pick up the hymn book that we've sung for years now, we know all the words, and we go, are you thinking about the words that you're singing? Are you looking up and smiling and honoring God with worship? When a song is sung to you from any kind of performance, would you appreciate it if the singers sang with their heads buried in their music or their backs to you? No. Part of what the enjoyment is seeing the enjoyment on their faces of performing. I was a young ambassador at down at Ambassador College, and one of the things they drilled into our heads is smile when you're performing. Have fun. If you enjoy it, people will enjoy it. There was a lady that has since passed in the Twin Cities that enjoyed singing. She sang with her whole heart. She was definitely not the best singer, but just hearing her brought joy to your heart. And you knew that it brought joy to God's heart, hearing her sing. That is an intangible that improves her worship to God. To flip this on the other side, some negative intangible effects. How many of us turn off our cell phones when we pray in these formal prayers to God in this cell phone digital age? If you as an individual and I are talking, and we're having a good conversation, a deep conversation, a fabulous conversation, and my phone rings, I go, oh, hang on a sec. I got to take this. Very important. What am I saying? I'm saying that the person on the other end of this phone that you can't even see, you can't even hear, you can't be involved in the conversation is more important than you. Right? So if we're in our prayers to God and we're having our communication with God and a phone rings and we go and pick up that phone, what are we saying? We're saying, hang on, God. We'll put this on hold for music. Listen to hold music. I'll be back with you as soon as I can. I take my phone call because he is more important than you. Scary thought, isn't it? That is a negative intangible that will decrease the number of widgets that our system is producing. It will decrease the quality. Take a look over at Matthew chapter 6. This is when Christ is giving explanation on how we should pray. And again, a lot of times I'm focusing here on prayer, but you can take this into every aspect. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 6. It says, "But when you pray, go into your room, and when you have shut the door, pray to your Father who is in a secret place, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly." That That probably worked just fine in the non-digital age that he was in. You shut the door and everything's, you know, shut out around you. Now there are a lot of distractions that can come into play. Do we shut those out as well? Again, down in Ambassador, they had what they call prayer closets in the dorms, and they were very small rooms. There wasn't anything in there as far as clocks or anything like that. It was basically just a board that was, you could either sit on it or you could set your books on it and kneel, and that was about all there was room for in there. And at least in the old dorms, the door to that room was pretty heavy, and it was in between the study rooms where it should be fairly quiet anyway, so when you went in there, you were pretty much shut off from the world, and that was a fabulous environment in which to pray. Getting back to the sermonette for a moment, looking about how many things are we missing when we study the Bible. Many of us get into patterns when we study the Bible. Do the Bible in a year, I'll read the Bible in 2 years. If you change that up, you may find an intangible that helps you out to produce more widgets. If you study the Bible in 2 years, try, you know, studying the Bible in 4 years. Take it at a slower pace. But put more focus, put the same amount of time every day into it, focus on the scriptures that are there that you're reading. If you read it very slowly in the past, try reading it quickly. Try doing it in a year to get the story flow. See what other things you might be missing when you read it slowly. And if you find that some of those things improve the process, improve yourself and how you worship God, then hang on to those. Those are improvements to the process. And if you don't find that they help, or you find that it's diminishing your ability to study, then go back. You know, try to remove any intangibles that degrade your worship of God. So that was step number two. You know, E.G. Toyota said, you know, if the system's coming through and you've got 10 widgets at the end of the day and something happens that now you're producing 11 widgets, figure out what that was. Figure out why you're producing 11 widgets, because that's great. We're producing more of the same quality. Document that in your book. If all of a sudden I'm producing 9 widgets, figure out what happened. Figure out what's wrong. Maybe the humidity changed. Maybe I'm getting less product from upstream. And fix the issue. So you're back up to your baseline. Once again, you can't do this unless you have documentation on what you've done in the past. So we document out our baseline, then we look for either things that improve that or things that degrade that. Step number three says examine the way that the user applies the product, and that may lead to improvements in the product itself. Look for ways that the user applies the product. So, for example, a ballpoint pen. You look at the Bic pen. Perfectly useful. But when I put it in my pocket, it leaks. Right? So, okay, well, let's develop a cap for it. Oh, why didn't I think of that? Perfect idea. Great. It's an improvement to the process. Make a pen that retracts, has the little button, the little clicker on it. I'm sure there's a term for that, but I don't know what it is. So you click the little button and the ballpoint pen retracts up into the pen so it doesn't touch anything, it doesn't leak. Fabulous idea. It's an improvement to how people use it. Who is the user of our product that we're producing? God, right? God is the one that sets things in motion. He's the one that will use us to his end if we allow him to. Turn over to Revelation chapter 5. Revelation chapter 5 and verse 9. Revelation 5, verse 9, it says, "And they sang a new song, saying, 'You are worthy to take the scrolls and to open the seals, for you were slain and have redeemed us to God by your blood out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation, and have made us kings and priests to our God, and we shall reign on earth.'" Here we see one of the uses for the product that we are producing. The product that we are producing is to be a king and priest. And I'm reading a book now called Raising a Modern Day King. And it looks back at the good and bad kings of Israel and how can we take some of those traits and tie it forward. But one of the things that it focuses on is if we're expected to be a king in the future, we should be acting like it now. When you see the kings that were raised up to be good kings, they were taught at a very young age how to act with dignity, how to act with decorum, how to act in certain situations, so that they would present themselves as being kingly. Turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 12. Deuteronomy chapter 12 and verse 29. We're given a warning here. Well, ancient Israel was, and by extension we are. It says, "When the Lord your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to dispossess, and you displace them and dwell in their land, take heed that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, 'How did these nations serve their gods? I will do likewise.' You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way, for every abomination to the Lord which he hates, they have done in their to their gods, for they have burnt, for they burn even their sons and their daughters to the fire of their gods." When we look at the world at large and the Christian community, how do they approach God on their worship day? Many times, it's in the same things they were using to mow the lawn or whatever. Jeans, maybe a nice collared shirt, maybe not. Could just be a t-shirt, Vikings uniform. You know, they'll go in just about anything. And I get a kick out of talking religion with some of the guys at work. And I was talking to one guy about dress at church. You know, how should we dress when we come before God? And he said, "Well, I'm a New Testament Christian. Christ accepts me as I am." I said, "Absolutely he does. And for that reason, you should honor him and respect him." And the way we do that in our culture is with our dress. If we show up in the grubbiest outfit, to somebody's table for dinner, would you feel like they were respecting you? No. Part of our culture is that we show respect through our dress. And that has really declined in modern Christian churches over the last couple decades. We need to make sure we don't fall into that. Because what are we to become? We are to become kings and priests. When we dress to present ourselves in before God's throne, are we presenting ourselves as a king and a priest, or are we presenting ourselves as a beggar looking for handouts? It's much different. There should be something special about the Sabbath day when we come before God. Turn over to Revelation chapter 4. Revelation chapter 4 and verse 1 talks about the throne room of heaven that John was given a vision of. So just picture this in your mind. You know, when we come before God, we're coming before His throne. Revelation 4 and verse 1, it says, "After these things I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven. And the first voice which I heard was like a trumpet speaking with me, saying, Come up here, and I will show you these things which must take place after this." Now, if we stop right there for a second, you know, I grew up playing the trumpet. I don't play it anymore because you have to have a real nice embouchure to play the trumpet well. And when you don't play it for decades, that goes away, and you basically are starting from scratch. I know a lot of the fingerings, but I can't play the trumpet now. But when you hear somebody play the trumpet well, oh, it's a fabulous sound. I mean, it's so crisp. It's so clear. It announces itself in the orchestra. You think of the voice that this guy is speaking with. When we speak out about the Word of God, do we speak out with a crisp, clear, enunciated voice? Or do we try to hide what it is that we're doing? Verse 2, "Immediately I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne set in heaven, and one sat on the throne, and he who sat there was like a jasper and a sardis stone in appearance. And there was a rainbow all around the throne, and in appearance like an emerald. Around the throne were 24 elders, 24 thrones, and on the thrones I saw 24 elders sitting clothed in white robes. They had crowns of gold on their heads." You know, the contrast, if you've seen bright, perfect gold, so yellow, it almost looks fake, contrasted against perfectly white robes would just be stunning. It'd be fabulous to see. Verse 5, "And from the thrones proceeded thunderings and lightnings, thunderings and voices. Seven lamps of fire were burning before the throne, which were the seven spirits of God. Before the throne was a sea of glass like crystal. And amidst the throne and around the throne were four living creatures with eyes." And he goes on to describe this environment. Absolutely amazing. I think it was so amazing for John that he probably had trouble describing in, I just about said English words, which he didn't use, but his native language, you know, in written word, what it was that he was seeing. Would you not want to approach this kind of perfection with perfection? Would you not want to add to this environment by our being there rather than detract from it? This is how God is going to be using the product that we are creating. I think of it back when I was growing up. You know, you go running through the house after playing outside and you leave the track of muddy footprints behind you, and Mom always gets something on you about it. You know, wipe your feet off. In Minnesota, a lot more rain and mixed conditions there, and a lot of people are in the habit of taking their shoes off of the door. And every once in a while, I should have learned the lesson when I was a kid, but it still creeps back in. You go outside for something quick, and couldn't be because I'm getting older, but for some reason, you forget something in the house, and so you run back in, you think, okay, I know it's just in my bedroom. I just have to zip down the hall and get there. My shoes probably aren't that muddy because I was only out there for a second. So let me walk softly. I'll walk on my tiptoes. I'll take large steps. I'll do everything I can to not track mud across Amy's beautiful floor. You get whatever it is you needed. You turn around and you see these little splotches of mud. Oh, great. Now I have to take more time than it would have taken just to take off my shoes, clean up the mess. You know, when I read this picture about God's throne room, I don't want to go across that sea of glass with muddy shoes. I want to go across that with the best that I have. I heard it said one time that our inside is displayed on our outside. If our inside is kingly, if our inside is trying to honor God, then our outside will reflect that. The converse is not necessarily true. People can fake their outside to not match they can have a pretty outside with a bad inside. But if you have a good inside, that is going to shine through, and it's going to come out. So step three is to look at how God is going to use the product that we're creating. Step number four says, broaden management concerns beyond the immediate product. Broaden management concerns beyond the immediate product. If I am so focused on just myself and the product that I'm producing, then I don't have a view of the system as a whole. Why do we rehearse the plan of God every single year? Because if we didn't, we'd become so introspective, so focused on ourselves, that we wouldn't be able to look beyond the product that we're creating to what God's trying to do as a whole. To steal a phrase from our company's vision, go global. You know, look at what's happening, what God is going to do around the world. When I went into management for a brief period of time, I was mentored by my former CEO, and CEOs just seem to have these nuggets of wisdom, and you don't necessarily know where they picked them up, but one of his nuggets of wisdom was prepare your replacements. Prepare your replacements. Always be training up the people that are underneath you to come up and take over for you. That's contradictory to a lot of American thinking, which is more capitalist thinking, which is, I want to be in charge. And if I train up somebody to replace me, then they don't need me anymore. We need to train up our replacements. If a family business was functioning and the owner of that business, the patriarch, never trained up his replacements, the business would die off in 50 years when he died, because nobody would know how to take over for him. There is absolutely no way, growing up in this church, that I ever thought I'd be standing up here giving a sermon. But it's because of many of the people out here that we're training up their replacements that I'm up here. We never thought, you know, we'd get into college. We thought that we'd be swept off to a place of safety before that ever happened. Why do we need to train replacements? But yet there were people that would encourage the young people in the church to pick up the hymnals at the end of services and take them back. Service. You know, my dad always got there early to set up sound system, running cords for my dad. You know, so I know the basics of how to run a sound system. And I think that's something that the Spokane Church, in specifically, because I have a lot of knowledge and history here, has done a fabulous job of over the years. At winter camp this year, we had Mr. Imes, not the Mr. Imes, but the Mr. Imes there. And I was so impressed, not to embarrass you too much, but I was so impressed with his ability to come and step in and to work whatever was asked of him. He helped out. And that comes from being a part of a congregation that's what's expected, and being a part of a family where that's what's expected, and being trained up to be successful at that. You know, he could come and step into the sound system and figure out their lousy sound system, because he was trained up on how to work with sound systems and what that meant. They were training up, you guys have been training up your replacements, and it's fabulous to see. You know, I remember, you know, first spokesman's club that Steve and I went to down in the Miller's basement. And I was pretty much, I'd done some speeches in school, but everybody passes in school. You know, we're still of that generation where they don't want to fail you in school. But you get into spokesman's club, and now there are people that are willing to give you constructive criticism and point you in the right direction so that you can grow. We've focused on preparing ourselves. At this step, we focus on preparing the people that are coming after us, our children, our fellow churchmates. But again, we need to focus on what God is doing as a final product. And that is going to be worldwide. You know, I got nervous at certain times managing a group of 50 or 60 people. We got to think billions, not 50 or 60, not a church of 100. God is raising up all mankind. How many times do we think on a global perspective of managing billions of people? And of course we have God's help, but he needs our help as well. He's going to be using us to accomplish that. He's going to be using this product. Are we preparing this product in such a way that it will be useful to him when he raises up billions of people? As we prepare for Passover this year, we want to focus on quality improvements in our lives, in our Christian lives. It starts with establishing a baseline. Know what it is that you have been doing in the past, so you know if you're improving. Look for intangible effects that may improve that. Look for intangible effects that decrease that. If you find an intangible that improves it, strengthen that. Draw that in to be part of your pattern, your habit. Focus on the way that we should be living our lives in order to strengthen how God is going to be using the product that we're creating. We are to be kings and priests. Act like it now so that we are preparing that product. And think about the broader picture and how we'll fit into that. How will what we're doing today, how we're preparing ourselves today, fit into the broader picture of what God is trying to do? If we do that, then we will be presenting God with an offering of honor, an offering of integrity, giving him the best that we can give him, not pulling some old mutton out of the backfield that's on its deathbed. We'll be giving him an offering of truth, of completeness, an offering that will be acceptable. And we can give ourselves to God as an unblemished offering.